Thank you for the invitation and the introduction. Yeah, so where does one usually start? Okay.
No. Far enough to see more. Very relaxed here.
Right, so first I want to talk about, I want to say what a positive geometry is. So this is a definition that I came up with Akani Hamed. And by. So a positive geometry, it's a pair x greater than 0. And x will be a complex projective variety. Let's say dimension D, and it should be defined over the reals. So it's cut out by equations which have real coefficients, but I want to think of it as a complex variety. And x greater than or equal to 0. So that's a subspace of X, and it should be a closed. There's a subspace of the real points, and it's a closed semi-algebraic set. So this is cut out of projective space by some polynomial equations. This is cut out by imposing some inequalities. So they'll have to satisfy a bunch of conditions. For notation, we'll write x greater than 0 is the interior of the space. We're gonna assume that this thing is the closure of. So if I have to distinguish the two, I'll say this is the non-negative part and this is the positive part. So the non-negative part is the closure of the positive part, so that's just an assumption. And we're going to assume that this is an open-oriented submanifold. And again, it should have dimension D. So you really cut it out by inequalities, and you don't impose any further equations because that would decrease the dimension. And then I'll define the boundary of the non-negative part is everything that's non-negative but not positive, and I'll let the boundary of this notation denote the Zariski closure of this. And then I'll decompose this Zariski closure into irreducible components. I'll tend to assume that all these components will have dimension d minus 1. If there are some lower dimensional pieces, I'll just chuck them away. And so I can also write the notation ci greater than 0. So those are the non-negative points of each component. So everything with a greater than or equal to 0, I think of as a real semi-algebraic space. So something cut out by equations and inequalities, and everything which I don't decorate with a greater than or equal to 0 or greater than or equal to 0, those are complex varieties. For Unfortunately for my examples, it's necessary to allow x's which aren't smooth. So for the examples that I'm interested in, I think we can always assume that they're normal and irreducible. But that's not very important. So this is just notation. And the axioms of positive geometries are a class of such pairs, and it's defined recursively. So if d equal to 0, then x is a point, and x greater than or equal to 0 is the same point. And I'm going to, and it's allowed, so that's, so this is a legal positive geometry. And we also define something called the canonical form. It has to be either plus or minus one. So this, the choice is something like an orientation on this. So this guy, x greater than or equal to zero, is supposed to be an oriented manifold, and I have to choose an orientation. So in the zero-dimensional case, that's reflected in this additional information. So if d is greater than zero, then to check whether or not such a pair is a positive geometry, there are two conditions. So each of these pairs, ci greater than or equal to zero, is a positive geometry. Then need to check. Of one lower dimension. Dimension d minus one. So everything that happens on the boundary is sort of recursively satisfying this property and satisfying this definition. And then sort of the interesting axiom is there exists a unique rational. Meromorphic. Top form. So this is x is complex, x d dimensional. This thing is real d dimensional. I'm going to look at a top form which is denoted x comma x greater than or equal to zero, and it should satisfy the condition that if I take the residue of this form along one of these CIs, then I'll get the, by assumption, this thing is a positive geometry, so it also has one of these things. I have to get I have to get the canonical form of that boundary component. And this thing should be non-zero. And also these are the only poles, and has no other poles.
Are the poles all simple?
Yes. So these have to be simple poles. Right. So it's a lot of work to check something's positive geometry because the definition is recursive. So each you have to understand. So if someone hands you one of these things, in theory, you have to understand the boundaries of the real semi-algebraic part, and then check that every boundary is a positive geometry. So you have to recurse all the way down. Are there any questions at this point? Yeah.
So I'm pretty convinced this implies there are no regular top forms.
Yes, that's right. Right. So I already said that these are this in dimension zero, these are the positive geometries. So let me do some more examples. So let's start with dimension one. So what if d is equal to one? So by this comment, and my assumption that it's normal, I have a genus G curve, and because it has no holomorphic top forms, it has to be P1. So. So in this case, there's no choice for x, and then now we have to pick out in the real points of this some semi-algebraic set, and it should be the closure of some submanifold. In this case, you find that x greater than or equal to zero, it has to be a union. It's a union of closed intervals, and the intervals have to have non-zero measure. You don't take a point. And it turns out that any such thing will work. So for example, if I write in local coordinates, if x greater than or equal to zero is A, B were sort of in some chart, say 1 colon x of P1. Then what is this thing? It's this form. So you can also write it like this. Right. So this form has two poles, one at A and one at B. If you take the residue at A, you get 1, and if you take the residue at B, you get -1. So this is a typical kind of thing. And if you take a union of intervals, so then it's just the sum. Then the canonical form is just the sum. So these are disjoint closed intervals. And so in this case you can check that. So this is a classification of dimension one positive geometries. Okay, so it would be bad if you can't construct positive geometries with high dimensions. So there's a way to uniformly construct lots of positive geometries of arbitrarily high dimension. You can take any projective polytope. So now let P inside Pn be a polytope. So my polytopes are sitting inside a projective space. So so this is a bounded subset of the real points of Pn, which is cut up by a bunch of half spaces. And let's assume that my polytope has the same dimension as the ambient space. So the claim is that these all work. So these are all. So where I take a projective space, comma a polytope. Let me phrase this. If you run through the definition in the case of a polytope, what is the boundary of the polytope? That's the boundary of the polytope is union of all the facets of the polytope, So when you do this recursion, you only encounter polytopes at every step. So to check this is true, you the recursion only encounters polytopes. So you can stay within polytopes as you do this, as you check that these are positive geometries. And so the claim, basically, it doesn't seem to be sort of explicitly known, though it's not hard one, is there's a unique family of rational top forms, one for each polytope, so omega p, such that the poles of omega p are along the facets where, so I'm sort of abusing notation a little bit. The facet and its Zariski closure are sort of being identified. In the notation. So the poles are along the facets are simple, and the residues along a facet of this form is the form for that facet. And so that's such that one. And then there's a sort of, you need to initialize the recursion. And if P is a point, then this is equal to plus or minus one. So one has to be a little bit careful with this. Actually, the forms depend on not just the polytope as a subset, but you have to orient it. So they're always, the interior of a polytope is sitting inside Pn is a submanifold. You have to choose an orientation. So somehow there's always a sign choice. Okay.
Make sure I understand. This is P inside of RPn, right?
So P sits inside the real points of this. Yeah. Because somehow when I talk about poles, I'm sort of doing complex analysis. So I like to think of the first factor as having complex points. I use complex analytic language at the same time as sort of polyhedral language. Yeah. Okay. So let me say something. So this doesn't seem to be explicitly in the literature in polyhedral geometry, but it's not a particularly hard thing, and it's similar to some things that people working in convex geometry have thought about, but sort of this polytope form deserves actually more investigation, even just from the mathematical perspective. And even just for polytopes, there are a lot of things we don't actually know about this omega p. So let me just sketch how you prove this. Uniqueness is easy. If you've got two such forms, then the difference to prove uniqueness, you go by induction. If you've got two such forms and they satisfy these conditions, then the difference will have no residues, then it will be a holomorphic form in Pn, and so it's zero. And the existence is harder to get. So just to sketch the proof of existence of omega. You start by explicitly writing down in every dimension, you write down what the form of a simplex is. If you take the standard simplex on Pn, inside Pn, so the convex hull of all the points all the basis vectors, if this thing is just a product of D log, so sort of in chart, let's say. Right, so simplices have the nice property that all facets of simplices are again simplices. So to check that you get the right form for a simplex, it's a recursion that only involves simplices. And then now once you know what the form of a simplex is and you've checked that it's a positive geometry, you next triangulate every polytope. So then so that's the first step. And the second step is you triangulate P into simplices, and you use the let's write this. A union of some simplices delta I, then you check that this formula works. Sum over I. So if you have so this is something that has to be checked, and it's sort of a local check because the recursion is sort of local along every boundary component. So you check that this form, which is the sum of the forms for the triangulation, works. Any questions? So this construction gives a large family of positive geometry. So it's not a sort of vacuous theory. So when you have a simplex, the form has poles along the n. So I have a simplex of dimension n, it's got n plus 1 facets. This form has poles along at n plus 1 places, and they're all simple, so it has no zeros. A form on Pn will have n plus 1 simple poles, simple linear poles. But if you take a polytope and it's got more facets and it's sitting inside Pn and it's got more than n plus 1 facets, it's got to have a zero somewhere. So what does this omega p look like? It looks like sort of the sort of product of linear forms for facets, and then something here, and then some dx's. So it roughly looks something like this. In the case of a simplex, there's nothing up there. But it's an interesting question for other polytopes, what's the numerator? One example is if you take a quadrilateral, then this form has the form is going to, so there's this quadrilateral will have four facets, the form will look will have the equations cutting out the facets in the denominator, and it's going to have something linear at the top because this will be a form on P2. So this guy is sitting inside P2. So it should have three, should have degree negative 3. There's a zero up here, a linear factor up here, and there's a convex geometry construction of that thing, which is the thing at the top is. Is the this my is this line is the line joining is the line joining the points of intersection of the opposite sides of the quadrilateral? So this whatever this form is, it knows a little bit about the polyhedral geometry of the situation. So it's often good to distinguish between positive geometries that behave like a simplex, which have no zeros. So if a positive geometry, the form has no zeros anywhere else, then we'll call it simplex-like. Otherwise, it's sort of a harder version, and it's polytope-like. Okay. So let me talk about more examples of this, these kinds of things. So hopefully some of them are familiar.
Sorry, so in this example, you were saying for a quadrilateral in P2, you have exactly one linear form and then numerator. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So it belongs to, it should be a section, this should be a section of the bundle O minus 3. Right. So it should be a section of this guy. So it should have degree negative 3.
And if you had a pentagon instead?
Right. So in the pentagon, you need to find a conic to put at the top. And there's also a projective geometry construction of the conic. And if you have if I remember correctly, there's some conic and it looks a little bit like this. It kind of touches the vertices. Some particular conic that's constructed in some projective geometry way. Yeah. So even for polygons in P2, this form is not trivial. This is not a trivial thing to write down a formula for this.
Can you say something about convexity? Like, I'm having trouble doing this picture with a kite.
Say again?
Am I just being dumb? If I have a kite.
Oh, so this is.
And the line I think I draw when I follow your rule seems to pass right through it.
Right, so this is the picture for a convex quadrilateral. Are you talking about a?
You're saying if I have a concave quadrilateral, then there's something else. Is that? Yeah.
No, I think.
Just do it wrong in my head.
Yeah. So this is the numerator, in this.
I thought my form wasn't supposed to be zero.
No, there's no condition. So this is a good point. So we have another definition of something called a positively convex geometry. And a positive convex geometry is one where the zeros and poles don't pass through the interior of the positive part. But in the actual definition of positive geometry, there's no condition on where the zeros are. We only impose conditions on where the poles are of this form.
But I think he was concerned in this case about the fact that that facet is just a line segment, and that's supposed to have a non-vanishing.
Just about all sorts of things about like vanishing and orientation. If there's a zero on that line, then it seems like the orientation is switching as I cross it.
Oh no, you're taking the residue.
Yes, that's right. So the form on this in this part, yeah. So that's a correct observation. So the omega p here and down here. Omega p in this region will induce. Let's say in this region it will induce the same orientation as the underlying orientation of the polytope, and in this region it will be the opposite orientation. And so that's an undesirable feature, but there's a separate, but it's still allowed as a positive geometry. Yeah. So when it's convex, there are additional nice properties of these things. Yeah, but polygons which are not convex, they are also positive geometries. So when in this theorem, I was actually only thinking of convex polytopes when I wrote that down. But yeah, non-convex things are also okay. Right. So some. So more examples of these things. Toric varieties. So inside a toric variety is sitting a torus. T, which is so some sort of the open orbit inside a toric variety is some copy of the torus. This torus will have inside it some R greater than or equal to zero. Right this way. And you can take this to be the positive part of the toric variety. And then this C star has a natural D log form. So this thing has, so in this case, omega x. There's a natural form just from the coordinates here. So there's a natural holomorphic form on T, which is product over I d log xi. And that's the canonical form. So this one, so regardless of what polytope, so you can label your toric variety by polytope, but regardless of what polytope you take, this this form behaves like it's a simplex because it won't have any zeros. So even for a very complicated polytope, the toric variety is a positive geometry which behaves like a simplex. This is kind of a curious thing, and it's sort of explained by a side comment is how is this example of a positive geometry related to a polytope sitting inside projective space? Is that there's something. So I won't write down the formal definition, but there's something which we'll call a morphism of positive geometries in the case where P is a rational polytope. So if P has integer vertices, then there's a construction of the following type. And where you take a map, which is something that's called an algebraic moment map. It's a rational map from the toric variety to projective space that restricts to a diffeomorphism on the positive real parts. There's a way, whenever we're in such a situation, there's a way to relate the canonical forms of the two things. So this map is, it's a diffeomorphism on the positive parts because the positive part of a toric variety is known to be just the polytope. But this map has degree equal to the volume. And the theorem is that the canonical form of the polytope is equal to the push forward of the canonical form of the toric variety. This one has no zeros, but this one will have zeros. Okay. Anyway, that's one class of examples. Another class is sort of conjecturally you can take cluster variety. So if you take a cluster variety and compactify it suitably, so this requires some conditions on the choice of cluster algebra. Cluster varieties have compactifications. There are positive geometries. And in this case, if you give me a seed of the cluster algebra, then I just take the corresponding D log form. I just multiply D log of all the cluster variables. Another example is if you take a partial flag variety for a reductive group, and you take what's called the totally non-negative part of it. And so the case that's most important and most interesting for physics is to choose this G mod P to be a Grassmannian, so GLN mod a maximal parabolic. So that's kind of the main motivating example. Unfortunately, conjectural example. This is not a conjectural example, but this will lead to the sort of the main conjecture. We consider Grassmannian of K planes in N space, and the non-negative part of the Grassmannian is a subspace of the real points. So Y is inside the Grassmannian and should be a real subspace of Rn. The condition for it to be totally non-negative is that all the you choose a matrix that represents this this plane, and all the minors have to be non-negative. Let me use X and I want Y to be something else. So X is represented by X is represented by a K by N matrix, and the Plucker coordinate index, so delta sub I is we take the minor of this matrix indexed by the columns of I. One, three, four equals minor using columns. So this is a theorem is that this guy is a positive geometry. To check it requires understanding the boundary, sort of the boundary of the positive part, and then the boundaries of that, and so on. How do we understand the boundaries, and how do we understand this top form that's declared to exist on this? So there is a clean way to write down the canonical form of the totally non-negative Grassmannian, which is actually first written down in the physics literature. And is usually written like this. Something like this. So the way this form is constructed is you start with the sort of just the flat form on matrices, and then you divide by GLK. One way to think about that is to contract against the vector field given by the action of GLK. And then the interesting part. This is a KN form, but the mod GLK gives you a form on the Grassmannian. And then the denominator is the interesting part. This thing has no zeros, so it's no zeros on the Grassmannian. So this is this thing when interpreted correctly is a rational form on the Grassmannian. It has no zeros and it has n poles. So you recognize that as the anti-canonical class of the canonical class of the Grassmannian. So the poles are simple and they're all linear. So they're cut out by just some Plucker coordinate. You can also think of this. I won't say much about it, but this example. So this example is an example of this thing, but it's also an example of this thing. If you knew what the cluster structure of the Grassmannian is, then you pick a seed and you take product of d log of those cluster variables, and you will get a formula for this. Though with that, if you take the cluster approach to write down the form, it's much harder to tell where the poles are actually. So to explain why this is an example that works, one has to talk about the boundary structure of this, because to check that something's a positive geometry requires checking all the boundaries of positive geometry. So I won't do that right now. I'll say what I'm going to go to the main conjectural example, which is the amplitudehedron. What's the construction of that guy? We pick a linear map, a real K plus M by N matrix. And then we if you have a if you have a point in the Grassmannian GRKN, that's a k-dimensional subspace of this guy, we can apply Z to it. And usually, so let's make the assumption k plus m is less than n. Usually, if you sort of you take a generic k-plane here and you apply Z, it will still be k dimensions, because this k plus m is bigger than k. And the right, so the notation the notation sort of is a kind of weird to write k plus m rather than something else, but that's sort of the notation that's from the motivation. So what you do is you consider the following space A. So this thing on the right hand side of the equal sign is not always well defined, because there may be a k plane. When you apply z to it, it the dimension drops. So this map z, this linear map from Rn to Rk plus m, it induces a rational map for the Grassmannians. So z is not well defined everywhere. It depends on whether the k plane you pick intersects the kernel of Z or not. So anyway, so this thing, for some Zs, this might make sense, and some Zs it might not. If it does, we call it a Grassmann polytope. Yes, defined. Meaning that every totally non-negative k-plane doesn't intersect the kernel of Z non-trivially. If this is defined, call it a Grassmann polytope. And the nomenclature is suggested by the, if we're in the case k equals 1, we recover the theory of polytopes. If k equals 1, then what is this gr1n? So gr1n will just be pn minus 1. And inside it, you have to consider there's a subspace consisting of points whose homogeneous coordinates are non-negative. So that's just a simplex sitting inside. The n minus one dimensional simplex sitting inside here. So the one something whose homogeneous coordinates are non-negative. And then when you take this map, this linear map Z, and look what it does to projective space, that's how we make projective polytopes. On the Z. Right. To I guess P PM. So Z takes this projective space to a smaller projective space, and it will take the simplex to the polytope which is the convex hull of the columns of this. So equals convex hull Z. So so thinking of Z as a k plus m by n matrix, so a 1 plus m by n matrix, Z, each of these zi's are actually just points inside. Yeah. There was this technicality that sometimes it's not defined. Well, that's just the usual condition that the z's have to span a pointed cone, if you're familiar with that. So you don't always get a polytope. Sometimes you get something that sort of it wraps around the wrong way. But anyway, this is why those things are called Grassmann polytopes, because in the case k equals 1, you reduce to this construction. And in this case, we know that it's a positive geometry, so we sort of speculate that these guys are also positive geometries. So is this thing. So R Grassmann polytopes. Positive geometries. And in what way are they like? Are they like polytopes? If they're like polytopes, then there are a lot of things that we can do with them, and we'll understand the form, like I presented earlier. So the special case of interest in physics is if you impose a condition on the Z. So we call Z positive, which is a very similar condition to the notion of the total non-negative part. So we call Z positive if. So this guy is a linear map from Rn to Rk plus m. After choosing a basis, you ask that the minors are the maximal minors are positive if all k plus m minus are positive. In this case, you can check. It's not that hard to check that indeed this map induces something that's well defined on the whole total non-negative Grassmannian. And the image is called the Emperor tetrahedron, and it depends on Z. So in this case, this A equals A of Z is called Emperor tetrahedron. In the k equals one case, there's a name for this. It's a special polytope called the cyclic polytope. When k is greater than one, then we're not working in projective space. We're working inside honest Grassmannians, and this is a new object. So sort of the main conjecture, sort of the purpose of defining these positive geometries is to conjecture that this example is for any Z satisfying this condition, it is a positive geometry. Maybe I should impose that M is even. At least certainly some properties require this. But I don't know that it's broken when M is not even. It's certainly a less nice. So this. And not formulated in this language, but sort of the precursor to this is a conjecture of due to Akani Hamad and Trinka, which is that this if it's a positive geometry, then it has a form which is a rational top form on this Grassmannian. MK form. Oh, I guess this conjecture, M equals 4. So this thing, K comma K plus 4. So there will be a 4K form. This is a 4K form on this Grassmannian. This is something called the amplitude form. So I guess, and there's some jargon, 4. N equals 4 super Yang Mills at tree level planar limit. So this is a form. So this form is supposed to compute for you if the conjecture is correct. The form is supposed to compute for you tree level amplitudes, which are just functions. How do you get it from the form? So there's sort of a formal procedure. There's a formal procedure to recover the amplitude from this. Let me sketch that. I don't know any quantum field theory, but the way you're supposed to think about it is there's in this In this guy, there are four space-time dimensions, and then there's k fermionic dimensions. And if you pick a point in the Grassmannian, it tells you which k dimensions. So a point in the Grassmannian is a k-dimensional subspace. So it tells you which directions are the fermionic ones. So what you do is you kind of fix a particular usually written like this, the way I've been writing it. So this is four. And you think, so you fix a particular point in the Grassmannian, and then what that does for you is it chooses which dimensions are the space-time ones and which dimensions are the fermionic ones. So you then pick the z to be in the same, so since I put the first four, in the first four you put, you put the matrix little z. And in the rest of them, you pick things which are sort of linear combinations of fermionic variables. And these z's, so that's 4 by n, so those are momentum twister variables for the momentum of the n particles that you're interested in. So those things match the same place that you put your zero here. And then the fermionic information is sort of in the other k dimension. So there's a lot of complicated linear algebra that I don't remember called spinor helicity formalism, which tells you how to write your momenta of your particles into this 4 by n matrix. So it's rather non-trivial. Anyway, the amplitude, the super amplitude. Is sort of formally something of the has an expression of the following type. So you have to do a fermionic integral, and then what you do is there's a specific 4k form on the Grassmannian. If you take the ratio between this guy, I guess I should give this a name. This guy is n k 4. So there's some notation here which I won't actually explain. It looks like this. So this is a top form on this Grassmannian, and you divide it by something like this, and this thing depends on y and z. And this thing turns into a rational function that depends on y and z. And then you substitute y is equal to this y0, and z is equal to this thing. And then you integrate out something here, and that turns into your answer. Okay, so that was just a sketch of the relation to quantum field theory.
But you didn't use the positive part here, right?
No, there's no. So the positive part is to, right. So at this stage, everything is just complex analysis. Actually, there's no actual integrals to do because it's tree level at this stage. The positive part is used to figure out what this form is. So to get this form on the Grassmannian, I need to know the boundary structure of this.
You only need the divisors to fix this form. You don't actually need.
No, but you need to know what the residue is along the divisors. So this is a 4K form with a bunch of poles, but it's also got a huge zero. And we don't know what the zero is. So think of this like a polytope. If it were a simplex, then yes, if we know the pose, then the zero, then the numerator is zero. The numerator is constant, and we're done. But there's no formula for the numerator of this guy. So where the zeros are, the way we fix the zeros is we have to not just know where the poles are, but what the residue is along the poles. Yeah. So. Yeah.
The reason why we're interested in positive geometries is because we want to know about this form. Is that right?
Right. So the conjecture is that the geometry of this amplitudehedron, so this semi-algebraic set, the geometry of it is supposed to give you a huge list of constraints on this rational form, which means if you take residues, you get one. If you take residues, you get minus one. And that imposes tons and tons of conditions on this rational form, and it fixes it uniquely. That's the conjecture. Right, so I guess I'm nearly out of time. So one thing I like to say is that, to hope to prove these conjectures, we need to sort of make more systematic the analogy between polytopes and Grassmann polytopes. And we've had a little bit of breakthrough recently, so let me just mention one. So as I said, for polytopes, it's not entirely trivial, but also not hard to construct this form. So, and one of the issues is how different the amplitudehedron case is to the polytope case. Anytime you find a new formula for the canonical form of a polytope, you want to try this out in the Grassmannian case. Anyway, so we've made a little bit progress on the geometry of the amplitudehedron. Convex polytopes are topologically closed bores, and so it's a recent, last year proof of. Galashian and Karp that this guy, this thing is homeomorphic, is a closed bore, meaning it in that sense it's very similar to a polytope, and our intuition for what the boundaries look like are sort of hopefully somewhat reasonable. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to prove that this guy is a closed bore, but that is also a conjecture. We can only prove it for special choice of Z. This is already special, that all the minors are positive, but we can prove it for one choice of a particular choice with actual numbers. So when the choice of Z is something called cyclically symmetric, this thing, the amplitudehedron is also a closed bore. And the sort of standing conjecture is that any combinatorics or topology question you ask about the amplitudehedron doesn't depend on the actual values of Z as long as it's positive. Oh, also I should say that this positive thing is used to determine the form. After you've determined the form, these Zs are just complex. The positivity is gone. When you calculate a super amplitude, the positivity is not there. The Zs are just whatever the input to your problem is, you just plug the Zs in. It's only at the stage of defining the amplitudehedron that you have a positivity condition on the kinematical data. Thank you.
Maybe can you just tell us a little bit about the statement that you also prove about the parity invariance of the...
Oh, right. So...
the statement.
There are three parameters in sort of the amplitudehedron before we fix m equals 4. So these amplitudehedra and the amplitude form depend on n, k, and m. In the polytope language, there were only two parameters, sort of the number of vertices and then the ambient dimension. In polytope world, there's a famous duality called Gale duality, which you fix n and k, and then it switches k to n minus k. In the world of amplitudehedra, there's an additional duality, which is kind of also switching k to n minus k, but it switches k to n minus k in what's called momentum space. In this whole story, we've switched to something called momentum twister space, and what that corresponds to is there's a duality which is hard to see geometrically, but sort of expected physically, that you're supposed to be able to swap k with n minus k minus m, while keeping the other parameters constant. And this seems to be a new kind of duality from the polyhedral geometry perspective. It also comes from the Grassmannian duality, which is, I mean, there's this typical sort of well-known isomorphism, sort of just take orthogonal complements, but somehow this happening in momentum space gives you something which swaps these parameters in momentum twister space. And with Galashian, we have a number of mathematical results which say that this we can prove statements the statement is, if you have a triangulation, which I haven't defined yet, a triangulation of this amplitudehedron, but if you have a triangulation of the a n minus k minus m amplitudehedron, then I can give you a triangulation of the parity dual one. So there's a bijection between. So this is a bit weird because we do not know the existence of triangulations of these semi-algebraic spaces. We don't know that we can triangulate them, but we've been able to prove that if you find a triangulation of this one, I can give you a triangulation of this one. And we can also prove. So the other thing is that this form is not the same dimension, not the same degree as this form. This is a KM form, because it's a top form on the Grassmannian GR k plus m. This thing is a n minus k minus m by m form. So they're not forms of the same degree, but there is a way. The other thing we prove is that there's a way to wedge. You basically wedge this form with a form looking like this, but with n minus k minus m here, and then you wedge this form, assuming it exists, with the with that form over there, and you get the same form. So we don't know yet the form exists, and it's always a positive geometry, or triangulations exist. But if they do, then if it works for one, it works for the other.
And is this related to the talk you're going to do at 4, or is that a different duality?
That is a different duality. I don't know the relationship between that duality. There is a relation in that the relationship between this talk and that talk is the sort of totally positive spaces appear in both. But other than that, I don't know. And there are also integrals in that one, but those are integrals of something with a potential, right? And they're not the different to. Yeah, in that talk, I will also have some integrals, but they're different to. They're not like these integrals. I don't know the relation. But there's some similarities. In that talk, I will also use this form, but for a different reason. I don't know. I don't actually know the relation between that talk and this one. But there are Grassmannians in both.
Yeah, I'll just mention that Thomas is going to be giving the colloquium in the pure math department at 4 today. MC. Come a little early, there'll be donuts. All right, any other questions?